Well, good afternoon and welcome. It is an honor and a privilege that we have such a large turnout for this, and we thank you for coming. I am Nick Zola. I teach New Testament here at Pepperdine. Douglas Jacoby is beside me, and we'll each introduce ourselves in a moment. The class that you are attending, and it's being recorded, so I'm stating it for the recording, although I'm sure that you can read as well. It is Church of Christ and International Churches of Christ, The Rift and the Repair. So this is a two-part class. You're obviously in part one, and we will continue part two after a short break. So our plan is to give you enough time for questions, but the overall gist is that we're going to go through, the first half will be the rift, what happened between the International Churches of Christ and the Church of Christ, where the International Churches of Christ came from and so forth in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, and then get up to about the early 2000s with the International Churches of Christ, end the first class there, move to question time, and then pick up the second class after that. So let me say a moment or word about each of us and tell you who we are, and whom we represent and whom we do not represent, just to make that very clear. So again, I'm Nick Zola. I teach New Testament here at Pepperdine. This is my third year at Pepperdine. I did my PhD at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and before that I did a Master's in New Testament at Abilene Christian University, also in Texas. My background is in the International Churches of Christ. So I did not grow up going to church at all, and I became a Christian in high school. I was invited to church in high school in San Diego, and then from there in the San Diego Church of Christ, which was part of the International Churches of Christ. From there, moved to Boston, was part of the Boston Church of Christ. And then from there, went to Abilene Christian, where I started meeting with what in the International Churches of Christ was called the Mainline Church of Christ. And then from there, kind of made a transition and discovered more of my family, in a sense, is the way I might put it. And so from that point forward, have had a foot in more parts of the Stone Campbell Restoration Movement than I had begun. So did a degree at ACU, continued to meet with the Church of Christ there, went on to Baylor, continued to meet with the Church of Christ there, was hired for my first teaching position at Lincoln Christian University, which is actually part of the Independent Christian Churches, so another part of the Stone Campbell Movement, and then from there have come here to Pepperdine. And then Doug will introduce himself as well.
I'm Douglas Jacoby. I was not brought up in the church. We went to an Episcopalian church, but the first time I was reached out to was by, this is before there was an ICOC, in what we would call the Crossroads Movement. After Duke, I went...
Which we'll tell you about in just one
moment. We will. We're going to give you... And the first session will be more content-laden, probably less time for questions, but probably a lot more time in the second one,
if it's
going the way we think it will. When I graduated from Harvard with a master's in theological studies, and went to London. We planted a church there in 1982 that eventually became more than 2,000 people, and probably through the churches they planted and so forth, probably maybe 30,000 or so. I was on staff for 20 years in the UK, in Sweden, in Australia, and various parts of the United States. Right now I'm independent. Lincoln Christian University is where I adjunct in the MA program in Bible and theology. Been doing that for 7 years, teaching apologetics and things like that. And I'm a member of the International Churches of Christ in Atlanta. I love the church. I know so many people. It's been the spiritual home for me almost as far back as I can remember. And I'm honored to speak today. Also, I've had the benefit of visiting hundreds of congregations in the ICOC. Hundreds. So, firsthand knowledge.
Yes, very good.
Thank you.
And let's just end by saying whom we don't represent here. Right? So basically anybody else than ourselves.
You're representing me?
I'm not representing you either.
Be that way. We met about 20 years ago.
So. More or less.
Yeah.
And so it is important for us to say that, right? So we are not standing here representing either the Churches of Christ or the International Churches of Christ. We are representing ourselves as people who have studied both of these movements to some degree to try to understand where they each came from, why they broke apart, and how they are beginning to come together in certain ways. And that is our goal, as we'll say in just a moment, in terms of what our purposes are today. Just real quick, I want to get some thank yous in place. Some of these people are here. Some of them will be listening to this recording later, I have no doubt. And so I wanted to make sure that I acknowledge several people that I had either phone conversations with or face-to-face conversations with, to do additional research in addition to other reading research that both of us have done and that we've lived through. So Jerry Rushford, who used to run the Pepperdine Bible Lectures, has been very helpful. Jerry Jones, who was in the ICOC for a good time. John Wilson, who is present here. Roger Lamb, who continues to keep records of what the ICOC is moving into and towards. Greg Marutsky, who is working here in Los Angeles in the ICOC. Dave Pachta, who does work in various quarters of the ICOC. And then let me thank Mike Cope, who's not present here, but who currently runs the Pepperdine Bible Lectures and Harbor, for giving us this spot on the program. We are grateful to all of that. And then, let us then go on to the meat of what it is that we're doing here, and specifically what we are not doing here as well. Here's what I want to say to begin with. We are aware that the International Churches of Christ, the Boston Movement, the Crossroads Movement, and its various phases, has caused damage in the past. And we don't want to disregard that damage. We don't want to pretend that that damage has not occurred. So we want to acknowledge that. We want to recognize that there may well be people sitting here who have been damaged in some way, and who are still feeling some of that damage and working through some of that damage. It is not our object to erase that or to overlook that or to pretend that that didn't occur. Mm-hmm. And so we want to bring that into the room and make sure that we acknowledge that. At the same time, our focus is not to dwell on the damage particularly or necessarily. Our focus is to acknowledge it and then to see what we can do today to continue in the repair of that damage. And so, our main purpose, Doug will explain then,
is education with dialogue.
Yes.
Is that the right answer?
Yes.
Indeed. So we're going to give you some history, because some of you are part of the ICOC or the COC, or maybe you were just intrigued what those initials stood for, and you want to find out. So we have to set it in, we have to give some history to talk about how these basically end up becoming two movements. And then we want to talk about how they come together. As Jerry Rushford put it, and when was this? This was
2005.
Renewing an Interrupted Family Conversation. I was leading the International Teacher Seminar in 2006, invited people to speak from the Christian Church and the Church of Christ and the ICOC. And I began by saying, you know, we're brothers. I mean, we're cousins. I mean, how would your kids find out if you say, oh, yeah, we have you have cousins. You know, they live about 2 miles from here. How come you never told me? You know, I'm 30 years old now. I wish I had known. So it's a relational thing. And there's a rapprochement.
Yeah, and so then I wanted to use a fancy word here just to impress you.
That's Nick's word.
But the word, yeah, Doug wanted to make sure that I made it clear this was my word and not his word. The word that I thought of as I was approaching all of this is this idea of rapprochement, right, of coming back together again, a very fancy French word, which simply means drawing near again. And the implication is that you were once near before, right? You can't reapproach somebody if you weren't once already in their vicinity,
sure. Right?
In their proximity. And that's what, in many ways, Doug and I are hoping to accomplish with this, is to advance even further together as we come near together, as we recommit to dialogue, as we recommit to understanding that in many ways we are part of the very same family and the same team.
Right, and I was baptized in the Churches of Christ, not the ICOC, because it didn't exist back in 1977. If you don't like that French word, how about glasnost and perestroika, that openness and restructuring, looking at it from a...
Now you like my word more, though, right? You see? So,
they're all right. Good words.
Go ahead, Devin.
Right, so our first class has three sections. We'll have the dates, which we think, unlike some modern teachers and students, are important.
Yeah.
You don't know the dates of things. You don't know what preceded something else and what might have been a cause or might have been an effect. Then we'll look at the DNA of the movement, the ICOC. which is good and bad, and we want to be very open about that and even looking at impact. That's the plan.
Very good. All right. Here's where, if you could root it to one particular maybe movement or event or catalyst is perhaps the right word, where does what becomes the International Churches of Christ begin? And one of the places that you could point to very easily would be in what's called the Campus Evangelism Movement that began in the mid-60s in the Churches of Christ. I had the benefit when I was a student at Abilene Christian University. Jim Beavis and Rex Vermillion came and gave a three-part class at the Abilene Christian University lectures on the campus evangelism program and what it was. And essentially what happened was, in the mid-60s, there was already a campus movement that was burgeoning in the United States. Things like Campus Crusade for Christ, for instance, and other things like that began to happen in the 1960s. In the Churches of Christ, they heard the same call, and they said, we need to jump onto this campus ministry movement bandwagon and begin getting campus ministries up and active again in our churches. There was something called the Bible Chair program that allowed, very interestingly, people within religious organizations to function as a part of a university and offer accredited classes, classes that you could take for credit in religion and get credit for that through the university. And the Churches of Christ had Bible chairs. They had Bible chairs in various places. And that Bible chair program became kind of the seat of this campus evangelism program and attracted many of the people who were most interested in reaching students of the day. And that is what shifted eventually into the Crossroads movement.
One of the younger men who was influenced and inspired by this direction was a man named Charles Lucas, Chuck Lucas. And so we're taking you back to Gainesville, Florida. It's 1967. And the 14th Street Church of Christ sponsored a campus ministry on the campus of the University of Florida, which was renowned for being one of the top party schools in the entire world, probably in the solar system. I mean, they really party. My son actually went there. A couple of years later, they got a beautiful building, very centrally located on Southwest 2nd Avenue, called Crossroads, the Crossroads Church, the Crossroads Ministry. And they began to really go after not staying off campus, but going on campus. So they went into the dorms, even into fraternities, which is pretty gutsy, and starting conversations and starting group discussions, which they called soul talks at that time. And it was very, very effective. They also trained people to be campus ministers, and many scores were sent out around the United States. Maybe there's some in this room right now who themselves went to Churches of Christ and began campus ministry. But it was like a ministry within the ministry. And I think in some places, even a church within a church, which was, in hindsight, was probably not the best strategy. Is that enough
yeah,
for now?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, I didn't mention... Oh.
No, it just switched. So.
Okay, thank you.
Continue on this one.
I will continue. Now, Thomas Wayne McKean was one of many who was baptized in 1972. We'll be coming back to him very soon. He went to Philadelphia. He was sent to lead a campus ministry in the Philadelphia area, and then to Charleston, Illinois, Eastern Illinois University, where he spent 3 years. He joined Roger Lamb, who preached there. Now, when I was baptized as an 18-year-old, no one told me, you're part of the Crossroads movement. I mean, I'd never heard of it, actually, until the following summer, when some brothers in North Carolina said, we're driving down to Gainesville. We're going to go to Crossroads. I said, what? Well, we're going to hear Chuck Lucas. Who? I had no idea what it was, but I went to an evangelism seminar, and many times after that continued to go. 1978, as it turned out, my visit was the kind of the apex. This was the high water mark of the Crossroads Church. And I'm talking now statistically. What does that mean? I know it's a little obscure, but those 1%, that's a very low percentage, but let me tell you what that means. At the University of Florida, about 1%, or more than 1% of the 30,000 students were part of Crossroads. 300 out of 30,000. And Gainesville, 100,000 people, 1% of those, over 1,000, were at Crossroads. And I'd actually, so it's a small number, but I'm not sure I've ever seen that anywhere else, where they actually managed to evangelize a city and a campus so that 1% were part of it. It was an electrifying experience to visit there. The worship, the singing especially, all a cappella. None of this drum stuff. Well, by 1985, Chuck Lucas had been dismissed for personal sin. The Crossroads era was gradually coming to an end, particularly as most of their ministers migrated to what is called the Boston Movement.
Yeah. Very recently, Chuck Lucas passed away just last year in 2018. This is his obituary. We won't read it to you, but it's published in the Christian Chronicle. And so what happens, not obviously in 2018, but in 1985, when Chuck Lucas is dismissed for various reasons, a void occurs, you might say. By this time, Kip McKean has moved to Lexington. These stories overlap, and so we'll pick, you know, this story back up again in the next moment here. But by this time, Kip McKean, who had been in Charleston, Illinois for 3 years, leading a campus ministry there with Roger Lamb.
And baptized hundreds.
Yeah.
This was almost unheard of.
Highly successful, right? Trained in the Crossroads Movement and sent out by the Crossroads Movement, as were many other campus ministers, receives an option to go to Lexington in Massachusetts and take over as not only the campus minister, but as the head minister of the Lexington Church of Christ. And so he's already been there since 79. When Chuck Lucas is dismissed in 85, you have a series, a network of people who have been connected to this Crossroads group, who have been sent out by Crossroads, who are now all over the country, and who are now, in a sense, looking for a leader, looking for someone else to take over since Chuck Lucas is no longer present.
In fairness, a number of them migrated to Boston. In the early 80s, had already been coming.
Right.
But not everyone was sure what to do.
And so we could say, in a sense, this is the point when the Crossroads Movement begins to shift into what eventually becomes called the Boston Movement and labeled as the Boston Movement. At the end of each of these segments, Doug and I will offer a series of assessments. And so here's the end of the Crossroads Movement as it transitions into the what we'll call the Boston Movement. There were various strengths here. There were many strengths. There was an intense amount of Bible study and of prayer in the Crossroads Movement. And there was an intense amount of evangelism. Doug mentioned the soul talks, right? I've heard stories about Chuck Lucas or others coming into a classroom to give a presentation or something like that at the University of Florida and saying, raise your hand if you have not yet been invited to a soul talk yet. And one student in this class of I don't know how many, scores and scores of students raised their hand and said, I've never been invited. And Chuck says, I'll speak to you at the end, right? And so they were highly evangelistic, with a sincere intensity. The worship was powerful. It was a youth ministry-driven movement because it had come out of this campus evangelism movement driven by Campus Crusade and kind of the principles that came from Campus Crusade. Bill Bright is the founder of Campus Crusade. He was an early speaker at the campus evangelism seminars. And so they invited this outside speaker to come and give them the techniques and the programs and so forth. And they had open roles, or more open roles, I'll say, in women's ministry. And we'll see that even more increase when we come to the Boston Movement.
For example, in the Friday night student devotional, sometimes women would say audible prayers in the presence of men.
Scandal, I know. And it's easy to joke about that now, but in the Churches of Christ at the time, that truly was scandalous. And in fact, that's what one of the things that the Crossroads Movement got into a great deal of trouble for.
You see, the Crossroads Movement baptized almost all their converts were not from the Church of Christ. They were right out of the world, so they didn't know that women aren't supposed to pass out communion on Sunday. So
they didn't have some of the baggage that comes along with being part of a known group. Yeah. Now, here are some of the weaknesses, and you'll see these mirrored as we continue to go, right? So these are not distinctive only to the Crossroads section of this time. Already at this time, a certain brand of legalism began to emerge, right? A certain way of doing things that could only be done in that way, and a certain criteria, a set of criteria that needed to be followed or observed or patterned became the pattern there. Along with that, it became very personality-driven. Early on, around Chuck Lucas and kind of the pattern that he created, right? He, as we'll see with Kit McKean, was an influential and charismatic leader, and he drew people to him, yeah. And people wanted to imitate Chuck in many ways, sometimes even to the point of dressing and looking and speaking like Chuck Lucas, which we saw, we will see in some of the early days of the Boston movement. Now, here's what's interesting, and this is a weakness or a strength, depending on how you want to put it, because it'll easily contrast with the Boston movement in a moment. In the Crossroads movement, the vision was to put a campus ministry at every campus in the United States, which is actually a wonderfully bold vision. What we'll see in a moment is, in the Boston movement, the vision was to put a church in every country of the world. So we had the Crossroads movement, which wants to put a campus ministry on every campus in the United States, and we have the Boston movement, which wants to put a church in every country in the world. There was also sexual sin, and there were also abusive practices. Some of the damage that makes its way into the Boston movement had its roots in the Crossroads movement. And again, it's not something that we're going to intentionally dwell on, but it is something that we want to acknowledge occurred. And this is part of the narrative, and this is part of the background. All right, we can transition then into the next phase.
In 1979, Kip McKean, his wife Elena, along with friends of his from Tennessee, Steve and Lisa Johnson, they go to the Boston area, Lexington. And there's symbolism here. Lexington, the beginning, you know, the struggle against the British, revolutionary. And there was a small group who came together and were part of the Lexington Church of Christ, which had been there for a long time, but it was really slowing down and possibly even closing its doors. I remember because I was in my middle year at Duke, and they asked me to come and be what was called the 30 would-be disciples. I thought I was already a Christian, and I think I was, but I wanted to finish up where I was at Duke, and I said, I'll join you soon. I came in 1980. They were elders, Bob Gemple, later Al Baird, who comes from another local Church of Christ. But there was a paradigm shift, because in the Crossroads movement, the vision, and in the end of my time in Duke, I wanted to be a campus minister. The plan was very clear. You graduate with your undergraduate. You marry your girlfriend, you go to Abilene or Harding for Church of Christ schools, and you get your master's. And then you find a placement somewhere, probably in the United States. Well, this is a very different paradigm. And I give it, I think, to his credit, to the credit of Kip McKean and like-minded people, creating a church within a church is not really the ideal way to do this. He wanted the support of the church and said, I'll come to Boston, I'll come to Lexington, if the elders and deacons, if you will support me, and we're going to lose some people before we start adding people. He was very frank about that, and I think he was right in foreseeing the future. I came there in 80. By 81, there was a thing called a discipleship study. I was there when he did it, and it was a study that you would do with your non-Christian friends, and also we saw the favoring of the term disciple to refer to Christians, even though it appears nowhere in the New Testament of Christians except in the book of Acts. It's a couple dozen times. They use brother, friend, and so forth. And so we had a tremendous focus on evangelism. And just as in Kip's prior ministry in Illinois, the things in Boston were just explosive and electric. It was so excited. It made me so excited. I easily got people to come there from Harvard Divinity School. And the number of baptisms, you know, I remember when we first went there, the campus ministry, the ministry training program did a project. We researched all the universities in the world. And we heard cities I'd never come across before, but cities of 5 million or 10 million that were probably significant. And the vision was international, really, from the very beginning. Lexington was a small building, eventually renamed the Boston Church of Christ. Should I mention any of these other things here?
No, I think we've covered it well. I'll add to this. Yeah. So what happens is they outgrow the Lexington Church of Christ, right? You can probably speak to this as well as I can. Very interestingly, the Lexington Church of Christ purchases a building in Boston, so they're no longer in Lexington. And so they can't call themselves the Lexington Church of Christ.
Technically, they went to Arlington after for a couple of years, and then...
Okay. Yeah. Before they move into that building, the building burns down. And one of the innovations, and the Boston movement and the International Churches of Christ, we would say one of the strengths was its ability to innovate. One of the innovations and one of the ways that it moves away from the Churches of Christ is to say, we don't need a building anymore. In fact, we can put far more of our financial resources into mission work and into other kind of benevolence work eventually and into the work of taking care of the ministry if we don't need to sink all of that funding into a building itself. And so in many ways, almost by accident to some degree, what happens...
Unless it was arson.
Is there anything you'd like to say?
It wasn't me. I was living in London at the time.
Right. That what happens is that they shift over to this new model, which becomes the model of the International Churches of Christ and a defining model that differentiates it from the Churches of Christ. Now, something else that Doug hinted at that I think is worth just making explicit is one of the moments or one of the key turning points that happens here is that rather than plant a church within a church, right? So rather than send a campus minister to an existing Church of Christ to work within that Church of Christ and to bring about reform and change, there is a moment sometime in the early 80s where it becomes clear to Kip McKean and to others involved that this will be far more effective if we start our own churches, that we cannot... As Jesus perhaps might have put it, right, pour new wine into old wineskins. And so what we need to do is begin planting our own churches, which is some of the churches that we put here on the list that you can see.
These are the early ones.
The earliest ones, and they go on and on from here. What happens next are some of the sadder moments in the early history of the Boston movement and the International Churches of Christ. In 1986, they begin a program of what are called reconstructions. The first one is in Johannesburg, and others occur in various places, San Diego and so forth. What this is at the same time that they're beginning to plant new churches, they are also calling out the quote-unquote remnant within existing Churches of Christ. And so they find Churches of Christ that already exist whose leaders... are persuaded towards what Kip McKean and the Boston movement is doing, and are willing to tie themselves in. And often what would happen is those leaders would then move to Boston, be retrained. Boston would send new leaders to that church, and those new leaders would call that church to a reconstruction event and go through individual by individual and have them recommit themselves to full commitment of discipleship as the Boston movement defined it. And so many times churches would split. Churches of Christ would have splits over these situations.
For some of you, that may not sound like a bad thing, but the procedure, I think, in many places was invasive and humiliating.
Thank you. Yes, that is very right.
So 87, and starting that year, as I remember, I heard him speak, do a lesson on this five different times that year. Used Isaiah chapter 10, verse 22, a remnant will return. The idea is that even still, among the Churches of Christ, the Restoration Movement, there's a remnant of people who are really good-hearted, and they'll come. But we're calling them to come now and be part of the remnant, or we just consider you to be non-Christians. That was a horrible thing.
Along the way, various people from the Churches of Christ would, in a sense, change allegiance. They would switch over from the Churches of Christ to the Boston movement. The Boston movement, by this point, was controversial and had its proponents and its critics. And it became a very big deal if a kind of well-known member of the Churches of Christ would come over to the International, or the Boston Movement, we should say at this point. One of those people was Jerry Jones. And Jerry Jones did me the honor of having a very long conversation with me over the phone as I prepared for this. So I want to especially mention him and thank him for that. Jerry Jones was taught Bible and was head of the Bible department at Harding University, and left Harding University for various reasons, but one of them eventually becomes, because he was sympathetic to certain aspects of the Boston movement, he eventually moves to Boston and aligns himself with Boston. That becomes a very big deal to the Boston movement, and they tout his name. And
well, he becomes an elder.
Yeah, he becomes an elder in the Boston church, and because this gives legitimacy to what it is that they are doing. Now, unfortunately, it is not long before Jerry Jones realizes, from his point of view, that he does not agree to many of the practices that are happening in the Boston movement and no longer wants to align with the Boston movement. He ends up moving to St. Louis in 86 and then comes fully out of the Boston movement in 1987. He then ends up writing three volumes of work entitled What Does the Boston Movement Teach? And spends at least some part of his time informing the rest of the Church of Christ what are the distinctive features of the Boston movement in order to make sure that anybody who is considering aligning themselves is well aware of what it is that they'll be aligning themselves to. This becomes a pretty devastating moment in some ways for the Boston movement, because now they've lost one of the key figures that they liked to kind of present and say, look, we have the legitimacy. Another figure like Jerry Jones who doesn't end up leaving the Boston movement is George Gurganis, who was known for running the missions work and program both at Harding and then eventually at Abilene Christian University, did very early and pioneering mission work in Japan, and then eventually joins the Boston movement, moves to Boston, comes out of retirement, returns to Japan as a missionary because he is so attracted by the evangelistic focus of the Boston movement, and he stays in the Boston movement until his death in 1992. So you have two different kind of versions of that.
This guy was a giant of a man and a huge heart.
Literally.
Right after World War II, moves to Japan and then goes back with Frank Kim for the planting of the Tokyo church. The first time I visited Tokyo, I stayed in George's house. When he died, his widow gave me his overcoat, his London fog overcoat. So I remember him every winter for both weeks in Atlanta.
During this time, in the mid to late 80s, the Boston movement is refocusing certain areas. One of the things that happens is in London, they take up a love offering. They take up an offering to help the poor and the needy. In the London church, they're beginning to come into contact with people who have far less means than many of the people in the church, and they realize this is an area potentially of neglect for us so far. And then in 1987, Doug Arthur preaches a message to the larger assembled group. I think it's a World Boston Mission Seminar, right, in 87, and calls upon the church to begin helping the poor and the needy. Some years after that is when Hope Worldwide is formed officially as an official, although they had been starting this practice even before 1991. But in 1991, Hope Worldwide is formed as something of the benevolent arm of the Boston movement, as a way of taking care of the
or meeting. You could say the Boston movement was the evangelistic arm of Hope. Just turn it around.
I like that way better. All right, let's do some assessments as the Boston movement phase comes to an end.
Well, what was the case? Was there something else?
I think this is it. Yeah.
What was the case at that time, which is the case now? I don't think I'm being mean. The Churches of Christ are shrinking. The mainline Churches of Christ. I mean, there are bright spots here and there, but overall, they've been in a period of decline for a long time. And honestly, so has the ICOC. So I don't think I'm being mean about that, but the critics from within, those who love the church, mention those things a lot. But there's a perception, and it's true. So while the mainline churches are getting smaller, more and more churches are being planted around the world. So we went to London in 82. Chicago wasn't technically a planting, but New York was in 83, then Toronto, and after that, it was all over South Carolina. South America and Asia and everywhere, and eventually with hundreds and hundreds of churches, 600 or so. So the formal split happens, I think, in part because of the remnant doctrine. But when you're going to say, if you're not under our authority, we don't consider you Christians, that's just not good. Maybe I said it too strongly before, but I think that's wrong. That's too much like Diotrephes should be like Demetrius, referring to 3 John. Anyway, you can see the split, you can see what happens, and you look through the various documents, and eventually the Boston movement has changed. Its locus, its center of power, you could say, from Boston to Los Angeles. And Kip moves from Boston to... Boston's a big town, a big city, but not like Los Angeles, which is larger than many countries that I've visited before. And a new name is suggested by John Vaughan of Fuller Theological Seminary, and that name is...
The International Churches of Christ. So what happens in kind of the late 80s and then into the early 90s, the Churches of Christ would publish directories, right? Churches of Christ still publish directories to some degree, although it's...
Like where the saints meet.
Yeah, where the records are not kept as easily or as well today. But these would be published directories to know where all the Churches of Christ are, how big they are, and so forth. At some point, they have to make a decision. Do we continue to include Boston Movement churches in the Church of Christ directories? And Lynn McMillan and other people who are involved in kind of the editing of these directories and then also the publications of various Church of Christ periodicals and so forth, at some point between 87 and 88, depending on which directory and periodical you're looking at, make a decision to say, at this point, we've really reached a stage in which Boston Movement churches are not part of the greater association of the Churches of Christ. And so when these directories get published in the late 80s, early 90s, they no longer include Boston churches. That's what prompts John Vaughan at Fuller, who is a church growth expert, to actually contact the International Churches of Christ or the Boston Movement at the time and to say, listen, how do you want me to list you? Do you want me to list you as part of the Churches of Christ or to list you as something else? They actually go back and forth a little bit on this, and he says, well, I don't know. I think this is Roger Lamb, who's having a conversation with John Vaughan. He says, what would you call us? We're not really the Churches of Christ. And John Vaughan comes back and says, well, you're really kind of the International Churches of Christ. You have a much more global focus in some ways. The leaders of the Boston Movement at the time discussed that name and said, we like it. Print that. Go with that.
Well, the alternative, as Kip would joke, was cult. We'll go with International Church of Christ. His joke, not mine.
Yeah. Do you want to say a word on the assessment here, and then we'll move on to the next?
Yeah, I know. I'm sort of, when you live through it...
Do you want me to say a word on the assessment?
No, there are things that you want to say. I mean, you watch this happening before your eyes, but... There were, there were various brotherhood publications like Firm Foundation and Christian Chronicle, and they used to list all the churches that had 100 baptisms a year or more. And at first, in the list, we weren't there at all, and then we'd appear. But after a few years, we were dominating the whole list, and that must have been discouraging because we're clearly talking past each other. Strength evangelism, no doubt that's a strength, and the thousands of people being baptized, just the energy. You could say the youth, although it wasn't just youth. It had moved beyond. Not that Crossroads was only youth. Crossroads had a lot of older people, too. But that was kind of the breadbasket. Multiracial. I think in the Boston movement, it was easy. I mean, you just reach out to everyone. You didn't ask racial questions. And so the international churches are really integrated. I mean, where I go in Atlanta, we're probably 45 or 50% black, maybe 35, 40% white, and then Asian. We're weak on Hispanic, only about 40 Hispanic members out of 1,000 plus. But
and let me just say a word on that, because that is so distinctive when compared to the Churches of Christ.
Or the Christian churches, which tend to be monochromatic.
Yeah,
right?
The Churches of Christ have struggled considerably with integrating white churches and black churches. And this is something that, almost from its beginning, the International Church of the Christ or the Boston Movement simply figured out and was quite good at. And that's a major strength, especially, I would say, now in the world that we live in where we're beginning to recognize how vitally important that is to the body of Christ and to what it is to be called the people of God, to have that kind of diversity and racial integration, and to have had the ICOC focus on that so early, I think is a great strength to the ICOC.
Which, if you're a member of the ICOC, you're probably a bit blind to that. I mean, you know it, but you don't understand. An expert on racial diversity, a 75-year-old man, comes to church with me a couple years ago, and he's just blown away. And I say, it's not just Sunday. We're with each other in the week. We even marry each other. Now, I'm not trying to say that there's no racism in the ICOC. That would be silly.
Hardly.
But it's a great strength. Women's ministry, the international focus, there are many strengths. But their weaknesses, some are inherited from the Crossroads movement. The personality cult. This charismatic leadership model, which is not the best model if you want real-time feedback and you want maturity. Sexual sin. Resistance to criticism, which was called spiritual pornography. Don't read it, it's pornography. Well, it's not really pornography, I think, unless it's got lewd photographs. But it was a way of managing, of controlling, and increasing arrogance toward outsiders. You see, up until 87, we went to each other's conferences. When we planted the church in London, we cooperated with all the churches of Christ. We tried. I don't know how humble we were, but that did come to an end, especially once it was proclaimed that if you're not with us, you're not Christians.
One of the significant lacks at this point in the movement, and then as it continued as well, was a lack of deep, formal biblical education and training, a lack of an awareness of church history, really in some ways a lack of awareness of the churches of Christ and where this Boston movement or international church of Christ had come from and come out of. And so most of the people in the ICOC who had any kind of biblical degree or biblical training were people who had come out of the churches of Christ and had gotten that degree before the Boston movement kind of existed, or as it was still Crossroads transitioning into Boston movement. There came a point when that was no longer valued and no longer emphasized and no longer even encouraged, in fact, sometimes actively discouraged. There's the passage, of course, in Acts that talks about these ordinary and unschooled men. And that was emphasized considerably, that you don't need biblical training in order to be a minister in the kingdom.
Of course, the apostles only had 3 years of biblical training with Jesus.
Right. slight difference. I can remember living in Boston, at the end of my time in Boston, expressing to the leaders in my Boston campus ministry that I was interested in getting a theological degree, a biblical studies degree, and being discouraged, even then, in the early 2000s, by an elder saying, in one case, the Bible has already been translated, you don't need to learn Greek, or things like that, which may just be an individual case, but I think, unfortunately, is largely representative of the whole in terms of the attitude towards biblical education and understanding, which I find to be, and this I'm speaking for myself, as I am for all of this, I find to be terribly sad because of how much potentially could have been avoided, how much damage and hurt potentially could have been avoided if people within the Boston movement had continued to seek training and understanding and awareness outside of the movement, if nothing else, in church history, so that they could know and not repeat many of the mistakes that could easily have been avoided, which ended up being repeated, not just in church history, but within the Crossroads movement to the Boston movement.
The Boston movement cut out the Crossroads movement from the story. And a common question I'm still asked around the world, wait, you were baptized when? 1977. What? How can you be a Christian? There was no church until 1979. That's when the church came back to the planet Earth. You know, people think that. Go ahead, Nick.
We're here. Okay, so I'm going to use some terminology here, which is a little bit strange. We're going to talk about ICOC 1.0 and then ICOC 2.0 and then kind of 3.0, reverting back to 2.1. This language will make more sense in the second class. But what you could say is sometime in the early 90s, it transitions into what is generally known and becomes the International Churches of Christ. So in 1989, world sector leaders are formed. They begin to divide up the world into sectors, into regions. And again, there is this wonderful global international focus of planting church in the entire world, right? Spreading the church to the entire world. Doug has already mentioned how basically the center of the movement moves from Boston to Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Church, International Church, is planted in 1989, just a few months later, because of the leaders who initially planted that church having some difficulties. Kip McKean ends up moving his family to L.A., initially just to oversee a transition time, but eventually decides that they need to stay. And so they, again, shift the center, in a sense, from Boston to Los Angeles. And by 1992, Kip McKean is writing material where he describes Los Angeles and his intention for Los Angeles as becoming a super church, right? What we would call maybe today a mega church in many ways. And this is part of what is already becoming a kind of a mega church movement in greater Christianity in the United States at this time. So in this sense, the ICOC is not different in the trends of what it's trying to imitate elsewhere.
Let me just cut in briefly.
Of course.
Before 2003, as I recall, some of you will know the numbers, I think the average attendance of an ICOC church was about 500, which in other groups, other denominations, that typically only be like the top 3%. Very few would have the number, but for in most places, that was a pretty common number, 500 people.
Yeah. We're skipping, obviously, a great deal of material here, but what happens soon, 1994, is they formalize this desire to evangelize the entire world. The world sector leaders produce a document that they call the Evangelization Proclamation. We'll have a picture of it on the next slide or in two slides here. The Evangelization Proclamation. They sign it all as though it is the Declaration of Independence or something like that, or the Emancipation Proclamation. And what it is a six-year plan. The year 2000, I assume simply because it's a nice round number, is kind of agreed upon as the goal.
Well, they mistakenly thought the new millennium started that year.
That maybe they could have had a whole other
year
if they had realized they could go to 2001. And so they choose the year 2000, so they come up with a six-year plan to plant a church in every country that has a city of at least 100,000 people, which give or take, depending on how you do the numbers, is around 170 or so countries. And the idea, the principle behind all of this, is the idea that one of the mandates of the New Testament is to evangelize the world in a single generation. And the scripture that is often used to justify this is Colossians 1:23. Which, incidentally, as a New Testament scholar, it's difficult for me not to mention, doesn't say that. And it's very hard, really, to get that idea directly from Colossians 1:23. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, this becomes something of the mantra of the movement, right? Disciple the world, evangelize the world in our generation, in one generation. And I think one way to describe, in many ways, why the ICOC falls apart is because of this unnecessarily abbreviated timeline in which they gave themselves to evangelize the world. 6 years to plant a church in every nation of the world, which meant that as the deadline was approaching, people would be sent to some of the hardest countries in the world to evangelize who had very little experience with what they were doing. People who had been Christians sometimes for less than a year, right, would be sent to a Muslim country or a country that was very unfriendly to Christianity and be told, it is up to you to plant our church in this country or we fail this proclamation. And so the pressure was enormous.
But still, the Lord gave a lot of baptisms in this time of this concerted effort. And I always am a bit mixed in my... I meet someone who I think, you know, really, your church shouldn't have been planted then. Those guys weren't ready. But if that's true, then you never would have become a Christian yourself. At least not through our help.
Yeah.
So it's you can see the hand of God in both ways.
And that's why we've tried to emphasize as much as we can the strengths and the weaknesses here. Right, there is good and there is bad that is occurring. In the year 2000, the ICOC celebrates the completion of that goal, or at least we could say the technical completion of that goal. They do, by their own definition, in a sense, achieve the goal that they had stated, although several churches of those 170 may have 1, 2, 3, 4 people total in this church and are in either dire need to be replanted because they've already fallen apart or in dire need of further growth to really call them a church at all. By this time, though, as you can see on this slide here, 42 churches have over 1,000 in attendance, 15 have over 3,000 in attendance. There are 7 churches in the larger network of the ICOC that have over 5,000 in attendance. And I can remember being in Los Angeles or in other places where conferences would be held, where Kit McKean or somebody would say something like, "The ICOC is defining Christianity for this city or that city. The LA International Church of Christ is defining Christianity for Los Angeles." And that was the impression, and that was the goal.
And most members were totally unaware that there are other Christians outside. This is the evangelization proclamation, the Prince of It Small, that you can find it online. Quick assessment, it's a grand vision. There's unsustainable growth, but a grand vision. The growth rate is in decline, even in the early 1990s, and there's a true crisis in retention, every bit as serious as the crisis of retention of the mainline Church of the Christ that had been frequently been mentioned in an unfavorable way from the 1970s on. Unity and uniformity were quite confused, and more criticism, not just from outside, but from inside the ICOC. By the mid to late 90s, many people were very unhappy, writing letters, having meetings, and a lot went on behind the scenes.
And so that brings us to the transition, you could say, although we don't get there till really the end of this period and then into the next period that we'll talk about, of what we're kind of calling ICOC 2.0. So there is growing unrest, right? There is earnest critique both and has been outside the movement for quite a while. Now earnest critique inside the movement as well. There are already attempts to reform early on in the 2000s. So, for instance, Gordon Ferguson and Wyndham Shaw put out a book called Golden Rule Leadership that is all about consensus leadership, a model for how to lead a church. Wyndham Shaw and Gordon Ferguson at that time are elders in the Boston Church of Christ. This book is well-received in certain churches, not well-received in other churches, actually banned in some churches of the ICOC, which is kind of incredible. And the idea here is to say we need to move away from a single person leading a church, and we need to move away from kind of a harsh, authoritarian way of leading a church and move towards a consensus model of leadership.
Plurality.
A plurality where it is a group of people who are leading. It's at this same time or in this same year that Kit McKean steps down as the leader of the world sector leaders and therefore the leader of the International Churches of Christ. Initially, he takes what is called a sabbatical, what they call and he calls a sabbatical. Within the following year, it becomes clear that he can no longer continue in his role as the leader of this movement, and so he resigns in a more official capacity. Even before this, the Boston Church of Christ, of which I am a member at the time, and so I can remember this meeting, issues a public apology and has a meeting where the leaders apologize to the congregation, a congregation-wide meeting in 2002 where they apologize. Later that year,
there were like 5,000 or 6,000 at that time.
Yeah, over 5,000 people in the Boston Church of Christ at this point. Correct. Later that year, the world sector leaders meet in Long Beach, California, and depending on how you want to word this, they disband or they are disbanded. They lose influence. The world sector leaders begin to resign or begin to realize that they need to resign.
I would say they preferred to have autonomy within their world sectors instead of being under one head, corporate head.
Yeah. And then one of the watershed moments of the International Church of Christ history occurs, one that I imagine many of you, if you know this story, are familiar with, or at least have heard this term before. An evangelist in the London ICOC.
A Canadian.
Who's from Canada. I don't know why that would be relevant, but who's generally friendly, therefore. releases a letter, initially to leaders, but eventually to the body as a whole. He releases it online, or it gets published and made public online at the church website, at the ICSC website.
So it's the first draft of a letter, but unbeknownst to those of us who received it, he had BCC'd, he had blind copied other people who thought, well, I'm not waiting for the second draft, I'm going to send this out. So it went viral before we even knew the word.
He entitles this letter, Honest to God. And part of the reason that this is, and it's a long letter, over 50 pages long, part of the reason that this is such a watershed moment is because here is a leader on the inside who wants to continue and stay on the inside, is not leaving the ICOC, and yet who has issued a very grand and sweeping criticism of the practices, the authoritarian practices and other practices in the ICOC in a way that no leader up till that point had kind of dared to do, at least as publicly as Henry Crete does. Now, I think it's worth saying that if you go back, for instance, and look at Jerry Jones's material, the elder whom I mentioned who was part of the Boston movement for a while and then left, what Jerry Jones says is not very different than what Henry Crete says. But no one had been listening on the inside. And what Henry Crete manages to do somehow is to make people listen on the inside as well as those who had already been listening on the outside. And so this, in many ways, causes the ICOC to implode overnight. They have open forums, they have town hall meetings, many leaders, and some of you are present here who experienced this, many leaders are highly, I don't know what the right word would be, criticized by their congregations for their practices. A large majority of the paid staff of the International Churches of Christ within a year or two's time is no longer on staff.
The staff numbered in the thousands before.
By the end of this period, depending on how you want to draw the lines, at least 40,000 people leave the International Churches of Christ, which at that point is a 30% drop in membership. The height of the International Churches of Christ, membership-wise, is 135,000 people. 40,000 people leave after that.
Some people had left in 2002. In some places, this wave hit earlier. In some places, later. Okay, the DNA. I think we implied a lot of this.
Yeah.
On the positive side, the commitment, the evangelism, the innovation, the diversity, even the compassion for the poor. So many things that were great, and in most places continue to be great. But what's been unhealthy, a form of discipling or mentoring that's too controlling. And there's a way to be a mentor and a father and a mother and an uncle or an aunt, and there's a way not to do that. Putting new Christians into leadership, the Bible says don't put a new neophyte into leadership, but that's probably talking about a significant level. But to take someone who's just graduated from high school and say, here, you're in charge of 100 people, that's a dangerous thing, I think. Weak or non-existent eldership. Fewer than 10 churches even had elderships at the time of the 600 or 700, and it was very hard to have elders, and I think this is a reaction against the pushback from elders in the mainline church in that period of the 60s and 70s, which was quite turbulent. Minimal biblical knowledge. And lingo, which was used in some places and other places, they never heard of it. But I remember visiting in South America and Europe, they would say, what about the OTC? What are you talking about? The one true church. Oh, that's what the Jehovah's Witnesses say. We're the one true church. No, that's what we've been taught. Oh, my goodness. Or God's modern day movement, as though there's no other movement. Enforced tithing. And pressure, which Nick has mentioned already, to evangelize the world in one generation. Although at this time, it was at least two generations into the movement. Actually, they're coming up to their third generation. I'm still saying that I'll do it in one generation. Well, right now, the movement, as I would define it, is 52 years old.
We realize that we've come essentially to the end of our time, so I'm going to take advantage of you for one moment because I assume that you're probably staying for the second class. We'll extend over our time for just a minute. We'll give you a 15-minute break, and then, as I've said, our second class has far less material, and so we'll have, I think, a great deal of time for questions and answers in that class. So this is our last slide, so let me leave you with this and then release you for 15 minutes here. And we wanted to end with this again. Not because this is what we want to dwell on, but because we wanted to make sure that we understand and acknowledge this. As I was preparing for this class, I received actually quite a great deal of communication from people that I do not know once this was advertised.
Me too. A lot of people that you don't know.
Yeah. Telling me and warning me that the ICOC is a dangerous entity to be involved in. So I want to acknowledge that there are people who have been hurt, and there are people who are still hurt, and who are still processing and walking through what the Crossroads and then the Boston Movement and then the International Churches of Christ have done. There have been abusive practices, and these range from verbal to physical abuse to sexual abuse to, in particular, in many cases, leadership abuse, and we want to acknowledge that damage. It's important to acknowledge that. It is striking when you stop and look at the numbers and you realize that about 450,000 people were baptized into the, and let's just call it the International Churches of Christ, so from 1979 all the way up to 2002. About 450,000 people were baptized. Over 300,000 of those people left. So well over two-thirds, about 70% of the people who were baptized into the International Churches of Christ from 1979 to 2002 left the International Churches of Christ. That's significant. It is more likely to run into a former member of the ICOC than you are to run into a current member, even in 2002. There is a great deal of disrespect, and we could say this on both sides, right, shown to other Christian groups. In the Churches of Christ, especially in the Churches of Christ, is reciprocating this by far in the early days. And in our second class, we'll talk about the shared blame that occurs here. So we don't want to minimize the role of the Churches of Christ either here. And then this one, I think, is particularly poignant. What really started in many ways as a reform movement within the Churches of Christ and could have been a very healthy reform movement was a campus ministries-driven movement saying to the people in the church, this church is beginning to die, and we have a way of reviving it again. Work with us here. What started as a reform movement became its own separate sect, you might say, not in the in the sectarian sense, right? In the anthropological sense of sect, right? It became a split-off movement of its own. And for a great deal of time, right, between the kind of late 90s to early 2000s, there was almost no communication whatsoever between the two groups. More often than not, and I experienced this firsthand many times, as you went to a mainline Church of Christ website, there would often be a disclaimer somewhere at the bottom of the website that would say, in no way are we associated with the International Churches of Christ. Right? And they felt the need to make that clear to anybody who might be interested.
Right.
And then finally we get to the period where we're ending this part of the session. In around 2002, the International Churches of Christ enters into a serious period of reevaluation and redefinition. And that's where we will leave you for the next 15 minutes or so.
We looked at dates. We talked about the DNA, and each movement, each group does have its own DNA. And then we looked at damage.
Yeah.
So we'll see you at 3:15.
3:15.